They did so well with that. So very well. How are you all doing? You're awake? Yeah, kinda? Yeah, me too. At first service, I was kind of coming in a little disheveled, but now I've been here for like 6 hours, so I feel like at this point, I'm just here. But I want to give you guys an opportunity. I did this at the first service, and it helped me a little bit. So everyone just take a huge deep breath, and then let it out. We are here. You don't have to be anywhere immediately. You're able to be right here, present in this moment. And today, I have a slight mashup sermon because I was trying to cover the two topics from both services. And when I was working on the sermon, I was struggling with how to, you know, like, what is something that I constantly find myself in? What is a situation that I'm always in that's always a little bit chaotic and relapsing constantly back into? And when I was thinking about this, it was a little depressing because a lot of things came to my mind. But the one that just seemed to keep showing up is me on dates. Yes. So this will be a very vulnerable talk in some senses. I'm going to talk a little bit about my extraordinary dating skills. You see, one of the things that is really challenging, and it probably sounds strange, but probably most of you that know me know that it's actually not that strange. I'm awkward by nature, sometimes a little quirky, and most of the time pretty much oblivious to everything that's going on around me because I'm busy in my own world playing. And this oblivion, this like slight oblivious side of me is what gets me in the weirdest situations. Because I'm very aware, I have all the exits figured out, and I know how to get out of here if like the mafia is after me. But on the other side, I'm just hanging out, and I'm not really paying attention to some interactions that are happening. So this is where I think a lot of my challenges come in. And I remember in high school, I chose not to date. And I remember being a little weird about it because most people that I was friends with were like, we're in high school, we're gonna go on all these dates. And I had just come to the US, and so I wasn't really excited about dating. Most of my friends at that point were guys, so I had that like bros thing going on. I didn't like the anxiety of having to like declare undying love to someone at such a young age. I was like, this is gonna change. I know I'm moody, so why put this effort forward? And so like just in high school, I had no interest and I just didn't go on dates or date whatsoever. And then college comes around. And I went to a school called Southern Adventist University. Have you guys heard of this place? Yes. AKA, do you guys know the other term for it? Southern Matrimonial University. That's right, because they have like a freakish skill set of making sure that almost every student that leaves is either dating or married as they walk out the door, right? And so this kind of emotional overwhelming situation appears where I'm at this university where everyone's supposed to be dating and I just don't really want to. And what's so strange is that their dates are Friday night Vespers. Like, they'll call you on a Friday and be like, hey, would you go to Vespers with me? And then, like, I'm like, what? Why? Like, you can't talk. You're just sitting there awkwardly. At, like, what point do you get the person's name? Like, you know, it's just a weird situation. But that's kind of how it rolled. And I realized rather rapidly that I'm not so good at this game. This thing that people do naturally, I'm just pretty much an epic failure at. And so I'd like to share one of those moments, / multiple of those moments. One of those moments is I had just spoken for a week of prayer at Southern, and I was walking off stage, and I was talking to a couple people, and this guy came up to me, and he was like, wow, I really enjoyed that. I would really like to talk to you at some point. Can we get together and talk? And I'm like, yeah, sure, absolutely, let's talk. Why not, right? I'm thinking pastoral moment, what a sweet guy, right? And he's like, hey, can I pick you up? You know, we compared schedules, and then he was like, Wednesday. And I was like, cool, and I was like, I just get out of class, so just pick me up at the art department. And he was like, perfect. So I come rolling out of art class, right? So I was an art major at this point. And I'm pretty sure I had painting and sculpture that day, so I'm like covered and just crazy. My jeans are all torn up. Someone was trying to rub paint off my face. Like, I'm just a disheveled wreck, right? And I have like this big canvas and this like weird sculpture in my hand, and I'm walking out, and this guy rolls in like the most immaculate looking car I've ever seen, right? There is not one blemish or spot on the outside, and I'm like, huh. He's a perfectionist. He keeps everything very clean, good for him. He gets out, and no joke, his sweater is tucked into his jeans. And I remember being like, okay, carry on. And then he puts the stuff in the back of his car, and he opens my door, and I get in, and everything is perfectly clean. Like, his cup holders are clean. Like, everything's dusted, and I'm like, what on earth is this guy up to? And then he opens up the glove compartment, and he hands me a printed out list of all the movies that are showing that whole evening, and like a list of options with like menu options for different restaurants, because he heard I was a vegetarian. And I'm like, we're just gonna go talk. Like, I don't think this is a serious situation. So anyways, we get to this fancy restaurant called Panera, and we get in line. It's college, it was fancy, okay? We get in line, and I'm ordering, and before I'm like pulling out my card and I'm about to pay, this fool jumps in front of me and starts to order. And I was like, I don't know you that well. Like, I'm fine paying for you, but like, I don't feel like I know you well enough to pay for you. Anyways, and then he pays, and I'm like totally weirded out by the whole thing. And I'm like, what is happening? We sit down, and he begins to start asking these prying questions, right? Like, we're not talking religion or spirituality, and I'm not able to be that pastoral influence on his life, right? He's sitting there like asking personal prying, what brings you joy? What makes you passionate? What, like? And I'm like, what is happening? And then it hits me. And I grab my phone, and I do what every girl does, and I book it to the bathroom, to the, you know, space of healing. And I call my best girlfriend, and I was like, hey, hypothetically, if a guy shows up, super clean car, sweater tucked into jeans, I don't know what that's about, and pays for your dinner, what's going on? She's like, you're on a date, you're an idiot. I'm like, what? Hang up, and I'm like, she doesn't know. So I call my brother, right? And I'm like, hey, Ivan, quick question. Guy pulls up, super clean car, has his, you know, sweater tucked into his jeans, and then he pays for my dinner. And he goes, you're on a date. Stop calling me. So now what do I do, right? So I get back out there, and I have like my soup and my little sandwich, and I like don't know what to do with my hands, and suddenly I'm like stressed out, and I'm like, monkeys are cool, I don't know. I've always wanted a pet sloth. You know, and I'm like, everything has progressively gotten weirder. And I'm not gonna go into how that date ended, but let me tell you, it was a little bit of a wake-up call when I realized I was on this date. And the sad part was that wasn't the first one that I ended up on, or the last one that I had no clue I was on. Let's talk about a couple months after that. About a year later, it was my second year of college, and I had to teach. I was an education major as well. I was a quadruple major because I'm indecisive. And I was an education major, and I was doing my student teaching in Chattanooga, and I was teaching an art class. So I was doing sculpture, and I was really bad at sculpture. And so I asked one of the senior like majors, who was a sculpture major, I asked him to help me. And so we started spending a lot of time together, and we were working on these sculptures and how to do lesson plans and like how to teach it. And it was super fun and whatever, right? We end up at a hoedown. You guys know what that is? Yeah, okay. So we ended up in the middle of a very large field, and there are twinkle lights and there's music, and we're all like dancing and being goofy because, you know, that's what we do. And I remember I went back and I was talking to this guy. And my brother came over. He had been avoiding me the whole night because I'm an awesome dancer. And a couple of my other friends came over, and they're all standing around there. And at one point, and I don't exactly know who it was. I think it might have been my brother, but they're, no, not my brother, someone else, said, are you two dating? And I full-hearted, confidently said, no. And guess what he said? Yes. And I went, what? And my brother was like, really? So that's how I got my first boyfriend. We dated a solid year. Yeah. Okay. Let's talk. You know, you think that this may have been left in college, but unfortunately, the tragic tales of Sarah continue on. And when I was in California, there was this one particular day where I ended up on this, again, what I thought was a pastoral consultation. And I'm drinking coffee with this young man. He's sitting across from me. And everything that I thought he was going to talk about was turning back around to me, right? And it's that, again, awkward situation where I'm like, why is he so interested? Maybe he just needs to feel comfortable, so I'm like sharing a little bit so that way he feels comfortable talking to me. And then he's like, would you like to go on a walk? And I'm like, sure. So we have our coffee, we're walking down the road, and suddenly I feel like this, and then I feel... right? And I panic. And so I go right into rock, paper, scissors, right? So I'm like, ah! And he grabs my fingers, and then he lets go, and I'm like, ah! And he grabs, and then my hand, and at one point, no joke, I'm holding my coffee with his hand, my wrist is up in the air, and he's holding onto my wrist going, what is happening? Right? And I'm like, I don't know, this is the worst situation. I don't know what to do. And then he proceeds to kind of berate me and, like, tell me that I have a phobia. Did you know there's a thing called chirophobia? It's the fear of holding hands, okay? I got, like, 25 articles texted me and emailed me by him to let me know that I have a disorder on the fear of holding hands. But from my perspective, I just didn't know we were on a date. Like, I was just shell-shocked by the situation at hand. And so this is a running theme, something that seems to consistently be happening in my life, where I constantly relapse back into a situation just because I'm not paying attention. Now, the youth at first service, because I talked on this at first service, wanted to remind me of another situation. And so I've decided, since you have to pay attention, I'm going to give them the mic for a second, and they're going to humiliate me in front of all of you, and I have no clue what they're going to say. But Alan and June and Chen and Sophia are going to come up for a second, and then we'll keep moving forward, hopefully.
Hello? Oh.
This is terrifying. I want you guys to know.
I am a witness of how awkward Sarah is at dating. So as many of you guys know, 2 weeks ago, the Pathfinders went on a whitewater rafting trip. Amazing experience. And once we came back to camp, we were soaking, like, everywhere was, like, how would you say, like, we were all tired. We came into the bus, and then one of the experienced rafters came up to Sarah. Hi. What's your name? One of the most awkward introductions I've ever seen. And this guy kept talking and talking and talking. And to remind you guys, it's a bus full of kids. And this one experienced rafter and Sarah. Everyone was just staring, and we were just like, who is this guy? And then as time went on, she tried to be nice, you know, she's just like, what'd you say? You're like,
I don't remember. I just was telling him that, you know, I appreciate his involvement in our youth, but I got to get back to my job now. Super nice guy.
Yeah, sweet guy, but he's one of those guys that kept talking and talking and talking, and you try to be nice, so you just kept nodding your head. So as we leave the bus, we're eating tacos like 2 hours later, and he shows up again. Like, who is this guy? At our campsite. Like, how did he find us? And he was looking for Sarah. He was like, so have you guys seen Sarah May? Unfortunately, she wasn't there at the time. So he came back like an hour later. Still looking for Sarah May. She was there eating tacos with us. And he came up to us and, like, what was the conversation like?
He tried to feed me the fish that he was gonna, that he caught, right? He caught fish. Yeah.
He wanted you to go fishing.
Oh, he wanted me to go fishing with him. We hadn't gotten to the fish part yet. The point being, I had no clue what was going on. They're all dying laughing. And I'm sitting there like, la, 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 la. Oh, this guy wants to hang out with our community. How great, right? And I'm like, what is happening? And they're all like, Sarah. Like, Alan was like, we all need to walk 20 feet that way. We need an adult, you know? And I'm like, okay. And so they were my wingmen in saving me from life. But yes, so this is situations, right? You guys have witnessed firsthand. What troopers? Firsthand, the situations that I get myself into, and I'm unaware of it. Thank you, guys. And what's so interesting about this, it's all because I lost focus of what I was doing, right? It's because I wasn't paying attention. And this happens to me over and over and over again. And the reason I use dating is, one, it's just funny, but two, also it's something that throughout life, you end up in situations with other human beings, right? You end up interacting with other human beings, and sometimes when you get into that situation, you don't always realize what is playing out around you. I often relapse into self-induced chaos because I'm not paying attention. But the beautiful thing about it is that the youth found a way to find it hilarious, and help me move through that situation. The church community, whenever I'm in a weird situation here, helps move me through the situation. When any of us are going through grief or horror or anything like that, people move us through those situations. That's where our friends show up. That's where our community shows up. That's what keeps guiding us and moving us. It's amazing to find that support. See, there's something interesting about history. It often repeats itself even when we don't want it to. There's this relapsing of history and struggles throughout the Bible. Struggles with understanding law and God's plan. The tribes of Israel are hit pretty hard with this. As most of you know, there are 12 tribes of Israel. They're found in the Old Testament. They're descendants from Jacob, who's also known as Israel. They stemmed from the promise that Abraham's descendants will one day be as numerous as the stars. These tribes move through the Old Testament, each of them having a function and a skill set, each of them furthering the vision that was cast to reach the promised land. These tribes are often seen as centered around the temple. They raise their flags in battle together, uniting in times of war, focused on the purpose to expand Israel and to get their land as chosen people of God. At first, they listen to God and have success, and then they would lose focus, and they would lapse into human wanderings once more. We can see it through the Exodus story and pretty much every story that follows. In Judges, they can't help but lapse into worshiping local gods like Baal. And then they would get beat up and wonder why they would lose this focus and why they would lose that battle and get destroyed. It says that God raised up judges to lead, and when the people would follow the judges that God brought forward, they were delivered from those who plundered them. It says in Judges 2:17, yet they did not listen even to their judges, for they lusted after other gods and bowed down to them. The book of Judges goes into madness with people taking it upon themselves to interpret and to lead and to conquer. Only with the judges did victory and peace come in. And as soon as the judges had died, mass chaos came back. One such story is found in Judges 4 and 5. It says that the Israelites again did what was evil in the sight of the Lord after Ehud died. So the Lord sold them into the hand of the king of Jabin, who reigned in Hazar. The commander of his army was Sisera. Then the Israelites cried out to the Lord for help because he had 900 chariots of iron and oppressed the Israelites cruelly for 20 years. During this time, Deborah, who was a prophetess, she was raised up as one of the judges, and she would sit under the palm of Deborah in between two towns. And the Israelites would then come up to her and they would ask for her judgment and her wisdom and her guidance. And they would come to her asking lots of questions. One day, she sent out and summoned Barak, son of Abinoam, from Kedesh in Naphtali, and said to him, "The Lord, the God of Israel, command you, go, take position at Mount Tabor, bringing 10,000 from the tribe of Naphtali and tribe Zebulun. I will draw out Sisera, the general of Jabin's army, to meet you, and I will give him into your hand." She called Barak, and then she asked him to join the tribes together to go and defeat their enemy. Now, I love Barak because at this moment, he stops and he looks Deborah right in the eye and he says, "If you will go with me, I'll go. But if you do not go, I will not go." I love that he has this accountability and this ferocity, this willingness to say, like, "I'm okay to put myself in the situation, but we're a team when it comes to this, right?" And she said, "I'll surely go with you. Nevertheless, the road on which you are going will not lead to your glory, for the Lord will sell Sisera into the hand of a woman." Barak did as he was told. He summoned the tribes together and went to Mount Tabor. Sisera heard of this and gathered all 900 chariots of iron and all the troops. Deborah said, "Barak, up, go, for this is the day on which the Lord has given Sisera into your hand. The Lord is indeed going out before you." So Barak went down to Mount Tabor with 10,000 warriors following him. And somehow, in the midst of all of this, the Lord threw Sisera's army into mass chaos. And with 900 iron chariots and with all these military men facing just 10,000 puny guys, mass chaos broke out. And it says that all of them died by the hand of the sword. And it said that Sisera, at some point, jumps out of his chariot and begins to run into a small village nearby. He runs into the village, and he thinks that he's safe there because it's one of the tribes or the groups of people that have pledged allegiance to King Jabin, right? And he gets to this village in this area, and he runs by this tent, and this woman steps outside, and she says, "Turn aside, my lord, have no fear." So he turned aside to her into the tent, and she covered him with a rug. Then he said to her, "Please, give me a little water to drink, for I'm thirsty." And so she opened a skin of milk, and she handed it to him to drink. He was so tired that as he was falling asleep, he said, "If anyone comes by, please stand outside and tell him that no one is here." She looked at him, and he fell asleep. At that point, you guys know the story. It's one of the more gruesome stories of Judges. She goes out and she grabs one of the tent pegs and a hammer. And she goes in and she drives it through his temple as he's sleeping, and he dies in his sleep. Jael flagged Barak down and said, "Come, and I will show you the man from whom you are seeking." And when Barak walks into the tent, there his mortal enemy lie, delivered by the hand of a woman. After some time, Israel pushed hard enough and destroyed King Jabin. And at the end of chapter 5 of Judges, it says the people listened and the land rested for 40 whole years. What's so interesting about this is that Judges is basically an example book. It's saying, here's what you've consistently done, how are we going to move forward, right? And the entire book seems to be one big mood swing, shifting back and forth, going back into the redundancy of what has been happening over and over again. The relapsing, the unawareness, the oblivion, the losing focus, and ending back, right back in the situation that you started in. It's interesting, and I thought it was just fun to realize, that if you even start at just Judges 2:11 says, "And the people of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord." Judges 3:12 says, "Again, the Israelites did evil in the sight of the Lord." And then it says, "The people listened, and they had 80 years of peace." And then Judges 4 says, "And the people of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord. And the people listened, and then there was rest for 40 years. And then you go right back into it. The Israelites did evil in the sight of the Lord. Constantly this whiplash of getting it right, having peace, figuring it out for a time, and then turning around and ending right back up where you started. And this is our life, right? This is what we deal with on a regular basis, not to be super depressing, but that's kind of where we are a lot of the time, right? Things start going well, and suddenly people land right back where they started, missing the trend in their very own lives, losing focus on who God is and who they're called to be. There's a seminal line here at the very end of Judges. It's the very last verse of Judges, and it shows what has happened when you abandon God. Judges 21:25 says, "In those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes." One of humanity's biggest struggles is looking to something beyond ourselves and not getting caught up in our own eyes and our own ways. Throughout the Old Testament, there is a struggle to figure out the balance between law and God. Each community has a wavering relationship, where again, they do evil in the sight of the Lord. They relapse back to where they started. And when you get to the New Testament, this is no different. People are trying to follow rules and completely failing miserably. This is why there's almost a bigger struggle when Jesus comes into this picture, because he messes up tradition. He messes up the one thing that they feel they figured out, and this is the box I can fit in, and this is how I can be successful. Jesus begins to disrupt the natural order of things, the things that have been for a really long time. He begins to change the focus, reinterpret the law, and talks about living, breathing temples. Instead of reading the Torah, he begins to teach the embodiment of Torah, the way, the truth, and the life. The tribes are no longer fighting over land, safety, and temple, but are now living it out. They are creating safety and creating temple, the embodiment of God following a greater commandment at hand, and that commandment is love. In Matthew and Luke, it says that Jesus called together all of his followers, all 12. He had tons of followers at this point, and it talks about how he went up onto a mountain, he prayed all night long, and then he selected 12 to be his closest friends, the people immediately surrounding him. He pulled together a group that would follow him through his entire adult ministry. He had a disheveled, bizarre group that he surrounded himself with, yet one that he would empower no matter how many times they relapsed and ended back in the same situation. When they kept their eyes on Jesus, they were pretty solid. But pretty much every time you turn around in the story of the disciples, you watch one of them mess it up royally. You watch one of them miss the point, and one of them kind of end up in their own side story trying to figure out how to connect back to God? Or how is this really what God is talking about? This isn't how it always has been. And time again, Jesus had to regroup his disciples and challenge them to refocus on what he was teaching them. He had to recast that vision in different ways so that they could restart and start facing things once more. Some people have suggested in theology groups that the 12 tribes move into the 12 disciples because that shows the continuation of God's love and guidance throughout Scripture. I don't really know if that's true. And honestly, that's not the point to me. However, to me, the biggest point here is that God is patient. Even amid the hiccups and the trends and the situations we end up in, God is patient and full of love. A great example of what was always happening with the disciples is pretty much summed up in one of my favorite stories in the New Testament. It's found in Matthew 14:22. It's a story where Jesus has just finished talking to the multitudes, and everyone's getting super tired, and the people are pressing in on them, and eventually he just tells the disciples, go ahead, get in the boat, I'll meet you later. So all the disciples clamber into the boat, and they head out, and they're in the middle of the sea, and suddenly a storm hits. I'm sure you guys have heard the story. They're in mass panic and freaking out, and they don't know what to do, and everyone's thinking they're going to die. The waves are getting bigger. It's getting darker. The night goes on, and suddenly, in the midst of their horror and their terror, they look out, and someone shrieks, a ghost! Now, I don't know about you guys, but if I was in the middle of a lake, looking out in the middle of a chaotic storm, and a being is walking towards me nonchalantly, I don't know what I would yell. And maybe I would yell ghost, but I probably wouldn't be trying to address the ghost, right? And here they are, they're in a mass panic and they're freaking out and they yell out, it's a ghost, and they cried out in fear. In verse 27 it says, immediately Jesus spoke to them saying, take heart, it is I, do not be afraid. And Peter answered him, Lord, if it really is you, command me to come to you on the water. And Jesus said, come. So Peter got out of the boat and he walked on water and came to Jesus. But then he got distracted. He saw the wind, he saw the waves, he saw the darkness. And suddenly all that was in him got overwhelmed and he freaked out and he lost focus and he started focusing on that chaos. And at that point, you guys know what happens. He begins to sink. And he yells out, Lord, save me. And he puts his hand up. And Jesus immediately reaches down, grabs his hand, pulls him up, and he says, oh, you of little faith, why did you doubt? And when they got into the boat, the wind ceased, and those in the boat worshiped him, saying, truly, you are the Son of God. Now, I don't know about you guys, but if I was in the situation, and I think a lot of us can relate to Peter, because Peter is one of those guys that's kind of a whirlwind and a mess the entire time, but he's truly authentically experiencing God in all aspects because he's pushing it, right? He's not trying to just go about things in the right routine. He's actively saying, I don't understand. This is what I think we should be doing. And he's putting himself in dangerous situations constantly because he has faith, but then it freaks him out, and so he steps on back. And for me, I remember when I used to read the story, it would kind of bum me out and upset me a little bit because I pictured, you know, like, I have the faith by saying, hey, if it's really you, call me out to you. And Jesus says, come to me. And I get out of the boat. Like, isn't that my part of the deal? Like, my part of the deal is to get out of the boat, right? And then when, yeah, a wave almost knocks me out, of course I'm going to look at the wave, and of course I'm accidentally going to sink. Of course I'm going to lose eye contact with you because life is crazy and this thing just happened. And then to say to me, you have little faith, I never felt like that was the case. But then I thought about it a little bit more. And I realized that the beauty of this is not that Jesus is saying you have little faith and you're an awful human being. That's not what Jesus is saying. Jesus is saying is you had so much faith stepping out of that boat. Why did you let these little distractions hiccup you once more and land you right back where you started? He's not saying that you're a failure. He's not saying that you can never make it back out. But he's saying, like, keep an eye on me the entire time in the midst of this chaos. And in the midst of that chaos, that's when Jesus actively reaches into the fear and the crazy, and he pulls you out, even if you stop paying attention, even if you mess it up, even if you lose eye contact. There's never a moment where Jesus is not willing to step in and pull you out. And I find that beautiful. This is a cycle that just never ends. People are brilliant and scattered. And just like in Judges, we beg people to go on the journey with us into battle. We face the things that threaten us, and just like in Judges, God promises to go before us, picking us up and rebuilding broken community over and over again. And I love that Peter is freaked out by Jesus and then immediately launches full force into faith in order to lose focus and scream out again, because this is my life. This is a regular basis for me when I realize that I've lost focus and I need to reassemble and refocus and catch eye contact one more time with God. I also find it interesting and brilliant that Jesus doesn't focus only on the elite or the easy to lead. He calls the people on the outskirts of the temple, not just the people on the insides. He gathered anyone willing to open their hearts to him in a new way, truth, and life. He started changing the war mentality of conquering land and gaining multitudes into a single building, to the mentality of love and restoring land and bringing the multitudes into a way of life. He began to breathe life and energy back into all of humanity. Jesus did his ministry beyond the walls of physical temple, through action, story, and heart. And every time the disciples wandered away, he would call them back. He would go with them and conquer fear and brokenness. He would empower them to lead and teach no matter how many times he sunk. God shows us love. The disciples began to actually let God work within them, as opposed to the tribes and judges that took it upon themselves to rule and lead themselves. And often, those tribes would just lose complete focus and would then be scattered once more, and another judge would have to rise up. It's beautiful what happens when we're united in vision, and the gospel of Jesus gives us a thing to define us and unite us. And this helps us and needs to look different. Old Testament to New Testament look different. Christianity over the years looks different. We as Christians must look to things that unify us and not separate us from the world. Our unifying factor that we have now, that is always present, is love. The way we live and breathe becomes different when we experience love. Jesus taught them and us to see what was true and good from a kingdom perspective instead of from a self-centered empire perspective. God didn't change throughout history. People changed. We're called to continue to change and grow and create space for healing and love in the temple, but not just in the temple. We're called to live that love outside of the temples, on the outskirts of the temple, with any human being that we come in contact with. And just like Judges 4, we're pushed like Barak and Deborah. Go, the Lord is giving it into your hand. And just like the story of Peter, Jesus calls us out in faith, and when we freak ourselves out, he reaches into that fear and he pulls us out. He pulls us out of our failure, out of our dead-end jobs that never brought us passion or hope, out of our brokenness, even out of the funks of people around us that are leaving that we no longer have there to help support us or grow us. Even in broken cycles, God is there. God teaches love and empowers our community to be the living, breathing temple with imperfections, but always seeking love. This culture shift is what is brilliant. There's this quote I came across. It's by this guy named Cory Booker. It says, "Before you speak to me about your religion, first show it to me in how you treat other people. Before you tell me how much you love your God, show me in how much you love all of his children. Before you preach to me of your passion for your faith, teach me about it through your compassion for your neighbors. In the end, I'm not as interested in what you have to tell or sell as I am in how you choose to live and give." We are a community of people moving forward in love. So go, love. We are a community full of dysfunction and distraction. God will go ahead of us and lead. Come on, let's lead. We are a community searching for faith. So crawl out of that boat and walk boldly on the water, because God is with you. Go. Be fearless. You may trip up, but even amid the hiccups and the chaos, movement, peace, and hope shine through. Go. You are not alone. Go.